Okay, I will call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:47 p.m. on Tuesday, March 17th, 2026. Present today, we have online Representative Allard, Representative Stapp, Representative Moore, Representative Bynum, Co-Chair Shragi, Co-Chair Josephson, Representative Jimmy, Representative Galvin, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Hannon, myself, Co-Chair Foster. Looks like we've got everybody on board here. And so if, just a reminder, folks can mute their cell phones. We have three items on the agenda today. The first is House Bill 34. That's the Innovation Council. After that, we'll take up House Bill 91, the Marijuana Tax Bill. We've got public testimony on that. And then finally, we added to our agenda, since we didn't take it up this morning, House Bill 52. That's minors in psychiatric hospitals. And so with that, first up, going back to House Bill 34, that's the Innovation Council. We heard the recap of the bill earlier this session, reviewed the fiscal updated fiscal note, had public testimony, and we have one amendment for the bill. I would like to invite Representative Holland staff Timothy Truer to please come to the table, if you could put yourself on the record. And maybe just give us again, oh, we have Mr. Representative Holland here as well. If you could come up, and if one of you would like to just give us a brief recap of the bill, just to get our minds in the right direction, and then we'll take up the amendment. Just a brief recap is fine. Let's see here. It looks like we actually have two amendments, correct? Two amendments. So with that, Representative Holland, thanks for joining us.
Great. Thank you, Chair Foster, and to the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to be before you again on House Bill 34. This is an act establishing an Innovation Council. The Innovation Council is a tool used in other states, including the model legislation for this one out of Oregon that was created 20 years ago, that creates a venue to bring together the university, economic development organizations, the state, and local participants that are involved in early stage business formation. Across the country, 100% of net new job creation in our country comes from new, young, scalable businesses that become Apple's, Walmart's, Amazon's, Rivian, the companies that define our economy and our new jobs. This council is intended to give Alaska an opportunity to clearly examine its areas of competitive opportunity and advantage, and to ensure that we link and align our resources into those areas that are specifically opportunities for our state. I would note, as reference, we pulled up the state's current adopted comprehensive economic development strategy and looked at the question of what does it tell us about AI? It tells us nothing. Mm-hmm. Our current economic development strategy, and I'm not knocking, and I'm just saying, you know, it's not keeping up. This council is designed to ensure that we keep up, that we see how the world is emerging, that we see the opportunities that are in front of us, and we lean into those opportunities and align the limited resources we have. I'd also note that we as a state have been reported to have lost 34,000 working age adults who have left our state for opportunities in other areas. This council and its model legislation out of Oregon is specifically intended to focus in on the question, are we creating an economy that attracts and retains Alaskans? That's exactly what Oregon did in being able to create an economy that was attractive and created those opportunities for the future in there. I would wrap up and note that the discussions we're having at this point in time have really reflected on the volatility of our current economic model for our state. Fundamentally, this strategy is around diversifying our economy, creating more jobs in many different emerging sectors, and creating an economy that is richer, attractive, and more stable, so that the volatility we may see in certain sectors is balanced off by a more sustained long-term economy that creates a great place for our families to grow up and a stable fiscal foundation for our future investments. So with that, I will be happy to answer any questions if there are, or be a resource if necessary. I note also that we have Director Lager, who's here from DCCED, if we have any questions from them as a resource. I appreciate their involvement and their availability.
Great. Thank you very much. Okay. So my intent is to take up the two amendments that we have before us, unless anybody does have any clarifying questions that you'd like to ask the sponsor before we get into the amendments. Seeing none, we'll first go to Amendment Number 1, and that is by Representative Stapp. Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Chair Foster. I will not be offering Amendment 1.
Okay. And is it at this time or just withdrawing?
Withdrawal. Total withdrawal.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Stapp. Okay. So that takes us to Amendment Number 2, and that is by Representative Tomaszewski. If you could move your the amendments.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Yes, I move Amendment 2.
Okay, we have got an objection. Representative Tomaszewski.
So a simple amendment, Mr. Chair. If we go to page 3, line 28, it reads, the council may establish committees and delegate the duties and powers of the council to the committees. I view that as a open-ending exponential growth in the committee. And my simple amendment says that the council may establish committees consisting of members of the council. And that kind of just creates some ad hoc committees within the council and doesn't exponentially grow the council to become just a labyrinth of many different committees. So very simple.
Okay, thank you. Maybe if we could get Representative Holland, if you'd like to maybe let us know if that's a friendly or otherwise amendment and your thoughts.
Thank you, Chair Foster. I'm comfortable with the amendment. I would note, and I'm curious about the intent, but I think that's been articulated by the sponsor, so I appreciate that. The original intent was that this council is, been reduced down in the earlier committee process. We reduced the size of it in order to make it a little more compact to help reduce the costs and complexity of it. But we recognize in doing that that there may be certain topics, for example, looking at issues around capital formation or particular sector strategy, say in artificial intelligence, that we might want to have a focused group of people to be able to really do a deeper dive, and that in that committee structure, you may want to be able to invite in subject matter experts or other members of those committees. Now, that can still be done without technically having a committee membership, but that was the original intent, was that that would allow the few people, and just to reinforce, these folks that are participating on this council are doing it for free. We're getting some really high-level, amazing expertise of the folks we're asking to work on this committee for free. But the idea of the subcommittees would have been a venue to expand out the participation. This amendment is fine. I do see it as a way to perhaps control some of the size of it. But at the same time, I just want to acknowledge that part of the rationale was to ensure we've got the broadest possible involvement in this effort that is otherwise a volunteer effort for many of the people.
Okay, thank you. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. And I guess this might be a question for either the bill sponsor or the amendment sponsor. But when I go to read this, we're changing on line 28. It says the council may establish committees. And then it says you then may delegate duties and powers. So the new language, the way I'm reading it, would say the council may establish committees of members of the council. So I'm wanting to just make sure, is it the intention of the amendment that only committees of the council are the committees that can be established? Because when I read it, that's what this says, as opposed to establish committees and that members of the council may be part of that committee. I just wanted to see if that was under consideration or what the real language was intended to do. Obviously, Co-Chair Foster wasn't as part of the process of the request to legal to draft this, so I'm not sure what the request actually was and what the intention is.
Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Absolutely. So, I mean, it's pretty simple. It's not the council may establish committees consisting of members of the council. So what it doesn't when I asked this question to the maker of the sponsor of the bill, he rattled off a lot of different committees that could be created from this. And to me, that's an exponential growth of this council. And so these are consisting of members of the council. So the 12 members that are on, is it 12? No, then I believe there's 12 members of the council can break up and form ad hoc committees. Like these three people want to talk about disasters. These three want to talk about energy. These three want to talk about rural health care. But it's not an exponential growth of the committee or the council overall. It's just using the members that are in the council to form these ad hoc committees. That was my intention.
Yep. Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions on amendment number two? Seeing none, do you maintain your objection, Representative Shragi?
I do.
Okay. The objection is maintained. Okay. So with that, I'm sorry. Let's back up for a second. I'm going to object. I think Representative Holland would like to say something. Representative Holland?
Oh, okay. Thank you. I just wasn't quite sure where you're going to go next with this. Just want to reiterate, you know, this amendment, if you'd like to support it, is fine. I think it's a reasonable amendment. I think I've articulated kind of, you know, how this committee structure might work. I think the intent of also trying to limit the size and the complexity of the council is a fair comment also. So I don't have any opposition to the amendment. So I just encourage you to go whichever way you want to on this one. It's good either way.
Thank you. And I actually didn't need to object because we still have the objection on the floor. And so is there any further discussion before we put it to a vote? Okay. Seeing Representative Stapp, did you have any comment? No.
I'm just ready to vote.
Okay. Chair. All right. Okay. With that, Madam Clerk, if you could please call the roll.
Representative Moore.
Yes.
Representative Tomaszewski.
Yes.
Representative Stapp.
Yes.
Representative Jimmy.
Pass.
Representative Galvin.
No.
Representative Allard.
No.
Representative Bynum.
Yes.
Representative Hannon.
Yes.
Representative Jimmy.
Yes.
Representative Josephson.
Yes.
Representative Shragi.
No.
Representative Foster.
Yes.
9 yay, 2 nay.
Is that 9 yay and 2 nay or 8 yay and 3 nay?
I think it's 8-3.
I think. Let's avoid the roll. I think I'm hearing somebody else said they thought it was 8-3 also. If we could just re-vote that. Madam Clerk?
Representative Hannon.
Chair Foster.
No. Representative Allard, go ahead.
Yeah, I apologize. Can we repeat what I'm voting on? I'm trying to follow along and watch as well.
Sure. This is amendment number two by Representative Tomaszewski, adding the words consisting of members of the council, page 3, line 28. Amendment number two.
Okay. So was that the first vote where I voted no on? That wasn't my intention. Are we redoing that vote?
Yes, we are redoing the vote.
Okay. Thank you, Foss. Thank you, Representative.
Okay. Okay. Madam Clerk, if we could please call the roll.
Representative Hannon.
Yes.
Representative Moore.
Yes.
Representative Stapp.
Pass.
Representative Tomaszewski.
Yes.
Representative Jimmy.
Yes.
Representative Allard.
Yes.
Representative Galvin.
No.
Representative Bynum.
Yes.
Representative Stapp.
Yes.
Representative Josephson.
Yes.
Representative Shragi.
No.
Representative Foster.
Yes.
9 yay, 2 nay.
Okay, so on a vote of 9 yay to 2 nay, amendment number two has been adopted. And just to double check, are there any other further amendments? I don't believe we have any. So with that, that takes us through the process. And if there is an interest in moving the bill, I would entertain a motion. Representative Shragi.
Co-Chair Foster, I move House Bill 34, Work Order 34-LS0353/H, out of committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Okay. Are there any objections? I'm going to take a brief at ease.
Co-Chair Foster, may I amend that motion?
Sure. House Finance back on record at 2:01 p.m. Representative Shragi.
Perfect.
let's see, I move House Bill 34, Work Order 34-LS0353-H out of committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes as amended.
Okay. Hearing no objections, House Bill 34-LS0353-H moves out of committee as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. And so with that, any closing comments, Representative Holland?
Thank you, Chair Foster. Thank you for the time today, committee, and for the work that you've done. And I appreciate the collaboration I've had with a number of you on discussing different ways to improve the bill. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Take a brief at ease, and our next bill up will be House Bill 91. We'll just have folks go ahead and come on up. So brief at ease. Okay, House Finance back on record at 2:03 p.m. And the next bill we are taking up is House Bill 91. That's the marijuana tax bill. Let's see, we've got Representative Carrick as well as her staff, Mr. Stewart Relay at the table. And what we're planning to do here is take public testimony. And I did also want to, before we get into that, I just want to let the public know that if you're watching and you'd like to submit written testimony, you can do so by emailing us at house.finance@akleg.gov. One more time, that is house.finance@akleg.gov. And so with that, just so everybody's on board with what this bill does, anybody who might be wanting to call and testify, Representative Carrick, or if your staff, Mr. Relay, would like to put yourself on the record and maybe just give us a real brief recap of the bill.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. So for the record, Ashley Carrick, representative for House District 35 in West Fairbanks. And House Bill 91 before you, just to briefly recap, transitions immediately from the current excise tax down to a $12.50 per ounce excise tax. And after a transitional period, phases out the excise tax and transitions in a 6% sales tax in the marijuana industry. Just one other note for the committee members. There are additional policy provisions in the bill, but just one other note for members is that it's important to couch any conversation about potential lost revenue with this legislation with the current industry realities. And we may hear some of that in public testimony today. If we do nothing on this issue, the industry is going to continue to face potentially very rapid decline, and there certainly has been decline in revenue over the last few years. And we could see a potential collapse in this emerging industry if we don't take some sort of action to transition and alleviate, both transition and alleviate the current tax structure and where that burden is placed. And House Bill 91 seeks to strike a balance between reduction of revenue and continuing to collect revenue, and to strike a balance between capitalizing the funds where that revenue goes and not taking action. So I'd be happy to answer any questions after the testimony too.
Okay. We'll go to public testimony in a moment, but I think we've got a question, Representative Josephson.
Well, sure. I don't mean to be the exception of the rule, but maybe just this once. Representative Carrick, I appreciate the reform effort and your concern with the industry. can you tell me what the Met Fund generates now and what it will generate if your bill is adopted as written?
Representative Kirk?
Certainly, through the co-chair to the co-chair. So in FY24, which is the most recent information that I have available, the marijuana industry in total brought in $27.2 million in revenue. The Marijuana Education and Treatment Fund received $6.7 million of that revenue. The Recidivism Reduction Fund received $13.5 million of that revenue. And $6.9 million, the remainder, went to UGF. Under House Bill 91, the fiscal notes project a potential reduction in overall revenue of $4.04 million, and that would be applied across those categories.
Just quick follow-up.
Representative Josephson?
So, I'm sorry, you were so quick in answering my question that I'm trying to catch up. You said the total revenue is 27.2. The recidivism reduction is 13.5. UGF is 6.9. And so the delta is somewhere for the Met Fund is what?
Through the chair, the Met Fund is $6.7 million in revenue in FY24 from the marijuana industry.
And last follow-up.
Follow-up?
Pinky promise. Your submission is that this bill would only reduce the $27 million by $4 million?
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, that is the fiscal note that we received from the Department of Revenue, I believe, is what it projects. An overall decrease with the transition to this new structure would be $4 million year over year projected to the total marijuana industry revenue. And again, that's calculated on a percentage basis to those sources. So 50% of the revenue currently goes to the Recidivism Reduction Fund. 25% currently goes to the Met Fund, and the rest of the 25% currently goes to UGF.
Thank you.
Okay, I just want to make sure I haven't missed anybody. I've got Representative Hannon, Tomaszewski, Galvin, and Moore. Did I miss anyone? Okay, Representative Hannon.
Well, I'm going to thank you, Chair Foster, because of where Representative Josephson left us. I'm going to start with what were going to be my second questions, but we'll start there. So you gave us, Representative Carrick, just FY24 standalone. Can you go back in time a little further and tell me what it raised and say FY22 and perhaps FY20? Because my recollection from the Department of Revenue is that the revenue's been going down. So those funds are already suffering losses because we've seen perhaps a misinterpretation of the current tax structure by some growers.
Representative Kirk.
Thank you, through the chair, to Representative Hannon. So just going back a little bit further in time, the revenue change from FY21 to FY25 is as follows. In FY21, the revenue was $30 million. FY22, we were at $28.7 million. FY23, $29.5 million. FY24, $27.5 million, and FY25, $25.7 million. You can see that there has been a decrease from FY21 through FY25 of around $5
million. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
And switching gears, can you remind me of the transition time frame in this bill from the current tax structure? Then we've got a transition period of a reduced formulated excise tax, and then transitioning to a sales tax structure. What is the time period of that? And then anticipated revenue once we have the new tax structure in place.
Representative Kirk.
And Mr. Chairman, I'm going to defer that one to my staff.
Mr. Stuart Relay, if you could put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Stuart Relay, staff, Representative Carrick. Representative Hannon, to the first part of your question, House Bill 91 will need to be amended to adjust the transition period. But that said, the Advisory Task Force on Marijuana recommended an 18-month transition period from when the excise tax is lowered to when the sales tax goes into effect. That gives the Department of Revenue time to obviously implement sales to the sales tax. And as Representative Carrick said at our previous hearing, that would be a friendly amendment to make sure those effective dates reflect that intent and necessity.
Revenue.
So the in the Department of Revenue's fiscal note, in the first year, it is assumed that there is a total of an $8.1 million reduction in revenue, and then in FY28 it goes down to a $6.5 million reduction, and then in 2032 it's $5 million reduction in revenue. So I would just add that.
Representative Hannon. Uh-huh.
Thank you, Chair Foster. So once the new tax structure is in place, we still are losing revenue. It does not anticipate a restoration to our higher level of revenue off of just tax collection. That would only be under additional purchases.
Representative Kirk.
Through the chair to Representative Hannon, that is correct. And the one thing I would just note is these fiscal notes take into account just by the current amount of sales what we would see with this tax structure in revenue. I think what's really important to keep in mind is that the industry is struggling very significantly right now, and the anticipation from both the governor's task force findings and from talking to industry leaders is we could very well see this reduction in revenue offset by increased business operation and sales. And I think that that's that is not captured in the fiscal notes, but I think it's worth taking into some consideration in the calculus here.
Thank you. Okay, in the lineup, I've got Representative Tomaszewski, Galvin, and Moore. Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Thank you for being here in front of us today. So the excise tax is being replaced with sales tax. Can you, that's kind of obvious, but can you tell us what is going to be included in the over-the-counter sales tax that the people are going to see when they go into an establishment?
Representative Kirk.
Through the chair to Representative Tomaszewski, that might be a better question for someone like Bailey Stewart if she is online. It sounds like maybe she's not, but you would see that sales tax at the point of sale.
So if I could.
Representative Tomaszewski.
So my question kind of is, you know, there is a lot of value added products that the marijuana industry creates, gummies, I don't know, all the different types of value-added products that one will, you know, would be able to purchase over the counter. And I'm just kind of trying to gauge and for the people listening and who are interested in this bill, that what exactly is going to be included in that. Is it going to be the the pipes and bongs that they sell? Is it going to be the gummies? Is it going to be just the marijuana? What is going to be included in that sales tax?
Mr. Stewart?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Tomaszewski. So in Section 13 of the bill, that's where the sales tax is established. And subsection H says a sales tax is imposed on the sale of marijuana and marijuana products. So I would assume that would mean products that include marijuana. But I'm not certain if it would include kind of the extracurriculars, if you will, but just the specific products with marijuana.
Okay, then that's fine. That's great. Thank you.
And just through the chair to Representative Tomaszewski, it's my understanding that when we say in this legislation marijuana and marijuana products, we're not including, say, I don't know how not to be crass, but we're not including things like bongs or hookahs or other instruments on their own, but the purchase of marijuana containing products.
Okay. So next question is going to be Representative Moore.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. My questions were actually answered in the previous speakers, so thank you.
Okay. Do we have any further questions before we go to public testimony? Seeing none, I'm going to go ahead and open up public testimony on SHB 91. And I believe we have somebody in the room here first, and that is let's see here, Thomas Azarella. And if you'd like to put yourself on the record, thank you for being here today. I think we've got one person online from what I can tell, one person calling in from Juneau, and one person calling in from Kisilov. And so with that, thank you very much for joining us. If you can state your name and your affiliation.
Great. Thank you for having me. Thomas Azarella with the Alaska After School Network and the Alaska Children's Trust. I'm the executive director of the Alaska After School Network. We're here today. We've been on the Hill today speaking around about the importance of after school. And one of those critical important after school funding streams is connected to the Marijuana Education Treatment Fund, which is the Positive Youth Development After School Program. That is a grant program that right now is $1.8 million that supports after school programs focused on middle school prevention programs around the state. There are 9 state grantees that are currently providing services in over 30 communities around the state to reduce the risk of youth substance abuse, including around marijuana usage. For us, you know, as you're hearing the bill, just, you know, I know there's already been comments and conversations about the Marijuana Education Treatment Fund. That is where the Positive Youth Development Program is housed and funded through. We just want to really ensure that the funding for prevention programs stays and increases. We know the demand for after school is high. For every 1 kid in an after school program in Alaska, there are 4 waiting to be enrolled. And the biggest barrier for that enrollment is there's just simply not a program in their community. The PIDAP Fund, Positive Youth Development After School Grant Program, has been able to reach to some of our most rural communities in ways that we've never seen after school in those communities, that this has been a tremendous opportunity. So I just encourage you, as you continue to debate and hear the bill, you think about the prevention funding that is being generated through the bill, and really ensure that we are not reducing the funds currently going to programs so that we can keep after school alive and well in Alaska. Thank you.
Great. Do we have any questions of the committee? Seeing none, appreciate your being here today. Before I go to folks online, is there anyone else in the room who would like to testify? Seeing none, if anyone's watching online, they can also submit public testimony by emailing us at house.finance@akleg.gov. So next online, we've got Mr. George Pierce calling from Kisilov. If you can state your name and your affiliation and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, my name is George Pierce, a 40-year resident of Alaska, and I'm calling up on House Bill HB 91, and I'm calling as a consumer, not as a retailer. I'm in favor of reducing the excise tax from $50 to $12, and introduce a 6% sales tax. And I live in a borough, and I get I'm already taxed city and borough taxes on this marijuana. Right now, Alaska pays the highest tax rate in the U.S. In 2021, our profit was $30 million. Now, in 2025, it dropped to $25 million, with a $5 million loss to our state. And these marijuana businesses are our mom and pops and our neighbors. You should be helping instead of you are running them out of town and out of business. Fix it for the kids. The taxes from the marijuana is supposed to be going to education. And what's happening now is people now are going back to the black market because your pricing is pricing them people to go to other places, cheaper places. So you can fix their problem. Reduce the taxes. Thank you very much for taking my testimony.
Thank you so very much. I don't see any questions of the committee. So we've got a question. Representative Galvin.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Pierce, are you calling in support of this bill or against this bill?
I'm in favor of this. Reducing the taxes.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pierce, for calling in. Next, I have Larry Wilcox calling in from Juneau. If you can state your name and your affiliation, Mr. Wilcox.
Oh, hi. Can you guys hear me?
Yes, I must have the wrong name on my iPad here. If you could state your name and your affiliation.
Sure, I'm not Larry today. Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the House Finance Committee. For the record, this is Lacey Wilcox. I'm calling today on behalf of the Alaska Marijuana Industry Association. First, I wanted to thank Representative Carrick for bringing forward HB 91. It's been clear for a couple years that she is trying to help Alaska's legal cannabis industry. And there are provisions in this bill that we appreciate, particularly the biennial licensing provision, quarterly tax filing, and other measures that reduce administrative burden for businesses and the state. Those are constructive improvements, and we support them. However, the AMIA does not support the tax provisions written in HB 91 before you. I want to briefly explain why that may be confusing, because in the past, the industry has supported proposals that looked very similar to this, including HB 119 in 2024. The reality is that the economics of the industry have changed dramatically since then and since the governor's task force report, which was released in January of 2023. Wholesale cannabis prices have collapsed as the market matured, while production costs across the industry have increased and are projected to continue rising. At the same time, the legal market is competing against a growing illicit market and intoxicating hemp products that operate outside the regulated system. The result is that licensed businesses are under intense economic pressure. We are currently seeing businesses close. I believe the count for 2025 was 25 cultivating taxpayers chose not to renew. As those licenses go unrenewed, state marijuana tax revenue continues to decline, and the regulated market continues to shrink. When the legal market shrinks, consumption doesn't disappear. It simply moves back into the unregulated market that's always existed. Because of these economic realities, the industry has lost consensus around proposals that introduce new tax structures, including the retail sales tax proposed in HB 91. Under this bill, marijuana would be taxed at a retail with a 6% sales tax. It appears that there is no protection against overtaxation once municipal retail taxes are additionally levied, which is an additional huge concern. At this moment, there is no agreement between operators that this type of change provides relief. What the industry still overwhelmingly agrees on, though, is much simpler. The current cultivation tax is too high. Senator Klayman's bill, SB 73, and its House companion, HB 94, provide a straightforward solution by reducing the excise tax from $50 per ounce to about $12 per ounce. That approach delivers immediate relief while keeping the existing tax structure intact. So from the industry perspective, the path forward seems fairly clear. We urge the legislature to take the good regulatory improvements in HB 91, combine them with the targeted tax relief in SB 73 or HB 94, and move them forward as a bipartisan effort to stabilize Alaska's cannabis industry. This is still an industry built by Alaskan business folk, but today many of those businesses are struggling to stay afloat. The goal should be simple: protect the regulated system Alaska voters chose to create, because regulation only works if the legal market survives. And our opinion is the fastest way to stabilize this market right now is to reduce the tax and give these businesses the breathing room they need to stay open. Thank you for your time, and I'm certainly available for any questions.
Okay, we've got two questions. Representative Stapp, Representative Galvin, we'll go to Representative Stapp first.
Thank you, Chair Foster. Through the chair, co-chair. So I understand, and of course, you know, I'm Republican, so I like cutting the taxes, right? So I don't want to argue that point. But I do want to say, you said one option. It would seem to me that the problem here is the lack of enforcement of existing law on illegal grow operations, right? Because it doesn't matter how low I cut your taxes. If you are getting crushed in a black market scenario, they will always operate and sell cheaper than you. So can you maybe in your expertise, tell us maybe at this committee, like, what is happening with enforcement? Do we need to look at that? And again, if we don't fix that problem, I don't see how you guys continue to be competitive through the chair.
Ms. Wilcox?
Yeah, through the chair, thank you for the question. Representative Gap, yes, you're right. You nailed it. I mean, we're going to be constantly in a bit of struggle because of that. What I've understood is that national enforcement at the DEA level down to the municipal level, so that could include the state troopers, federal prosecutors, DEA, the IRS, the tax bureau, every agency under the sun, isn't going to prioritize marijuana crime or black market crime unless they see a metric ton of illegal marijuana. And those are real directives that they have. So if there's a metric ton of illegal marijuana, they'll proceed to prosecution. If there's marijuana plus an aggravator such as fentanyl, they'll move forward to prosecute. Here in Alaska, the enforcement officers at AMCO only have jurisdiction over those with a marijuana license. They don't have any jurisdiction over the black market operators. That would be left to regular law enforcement, who are not allowed to prioritize marijuana crime that stands alone.
Fault, Mr. Co-Chair.
Follow up.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair. Okay, so on a solution, I think we're looking for solutions. Though. I see you mentioned the federal law enforcement. Obviously, I'm thinking more of the state, obviously, Department of Revenue, taxes, probably incentivized to want to get their money from these folks. And we have our local troopers and local law enforcement. Is there anything we can do with AMCO to maybe get them into the desired enforcement of these folks? I know they only regulate the license of the law-abiding people, but do they have a mechanism which they can at least report or refer the unlawful people to our local law enforcement or state troopers through the chair?
Ms. Wilcox?
I think that they do. Sorry, through the chair. I think they do refer and report, up to the Department of Public Safety, I would presume. I think that if you wanted to put pressure on anybody, it would be the Department of Public Safety and maybe the Department of Law to see through prosecutions. And certainly the director of AMCO, Kevin Richard, might have some more solutions. But I agree that we need to be exploring them, and I advocate for that kind of collaboration all the time.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Galvin and then Hannon. Representative Galvin.
Thank you, through the chair. Ms. Wilcox, I know you're familiar with the bigger picture here, and we just heard testimony from an after-school organization that's already looking at 1.8 million that they need, and we know there's going to be, I guess by what we've heard, fewer millions every year, at least 4.04 fewer million. And I appreciate your comment around HB 91 versus HB 94 because you're just wanting to keep the industry afloat. But do you have any other creative solutions that if we were to move to the 91, it looks like HB 94, we would be reducing from $50 to $12 per ounce, I think. And that, from my back of the napkin math, would put us at around 75% fewer dollars in revenue that gets spread around these various reentry organizations and a little bit to UGF. So what would you – do you have any suggestions around that?
Ms. Wilcox?
I think we're kind of in a triage moment. I'm hoping that it's an ongoing conversation. I know that there are folks who've said once you get your tax reduced to the $12, you guys are going to be so happy you stop engaging. I don't think that that's true at all. I think we're going to continue this conversation, but we need to stabilize. I think if you look back at the plateauing year, which I think was 2021, when the industry brought in $30 million, we could maybe think of that number as the potential, and then maybe take that 75% reduction from that number. The thing that changes when you go to $12 an ounce, at least as written in the Senate version, is that the tiers go away. So there is no longer a mechanism to misclassify, which I believe Ms. Hannon might have referenced, which is a problem. There are cultivators who are classifying their product as the lesser valuable for tax purposes, I understand it. I think that when that ability to misclassify goes away and everything is taxed as if it is of the same quality as the other, that could be one of the things that could provide a little less of an extreme reduction than just a flat 75% off of our lowest number from 2025 of 25.7 million. Other than that, I think we could see businesses come back online. We could see people in the black market leave the black market and come into the legal arena, I would hope. We could see innovation, you know, because there might be a little bit of breathing room. I myself, as a cultivator and manufacturer, immediately stopped creating new products. I immediately stopped growing my brand and my footprint and having new ideas. I put all of our ideas on hold years ago, waiting for this reform.
Follow up. Thank you. And the other comment that I heard was that 6% was too high now, given the new status of prices and such. In what I recall from, I think it was 2 years ago, was 6% was compared to the rest of the United States, not a high number. So if you could help me appreciate where we are today, if you know, I'd appreciate that.
Ms. Wilcox?
Through the chair, I think the marijuana taxes nationwide are kind of all over the place. Perhaps the sponsor's done a little bit, Stuart maybe has done more new research, but I think there are plenty of states that were attempting to change their tax one way or the other. Either they were trying to increase it or decrease it or change it altogether, kind of similar to what Representative Carrick is trying to do here. 6% looks low. 6% is lower than the average retail marijuana tax, which I think is 10%. Yeah. Those prices down there are much lower as well. So it's a typical Alaska situation. Our prices are just higher. The thing I think that really concerns us even these years later is the municipal tax piece, for example, in Bethel, which I think we all talked about when we were discussing HB 119. I believe Bethel 16. Has, boy, a 16% additional sales tax that would be added to the 6%. And then you priced yourself completely out of a legal, if you were a legal store, which there are a couple up there. I don't believe anybody is going to be able to afford to go into that store. And there are people just in the parking lot of the store selling black market material. So I think there's a discussion that needs to be had about all of that, which we would like to have. I don't think we've had that amount of dialogue yet. I don't see it in this bill. I would be very excited to have that conversation. We need the triage help years ago. We're getting really... I feel like I've been begging for years. I am apologizing, Representative Galvin. I hope that answers the question a little.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay. Next up, Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Ms. Wilcox, one of the things you said in your statement was that the industry has lost consensus around shifting to a sales tax model. So can I conclude from that some of the industry still supports it?
Oh, for sure. Yes. Definitely standalone cultivators, people who only grow and don't have a retail or a manufacturing license and all they do is cultivate. That is definitely going to be a person who's going to be excited to get the tax burden off of them. They're farmers. They're not accountants. They don't like this. It's uncomfortable. It always has been. I appreciate that perspective a lot. I tend to share that perspective most of the time. I also have a manufacturing license, so I can kind of shift some of the pain within my own business structure. A lot of businesses, though, over the years have now joined forces to survive and become vertically integrated. As that has happened, there's been less support because people are understanding that it over at the retail side, a standalone retailer may really oppose it because they have the concern about those compound tax issues I just mentioned.
Follow up. I'm trying to understand, because I think, you know, when we heard from the Department of Revenue, perhaps bad actors miscategorizing their categories of cannabis and as the lowest taxed, you know, as Trim, but that being the area where the highest product development profit could be, the value added production coming, that right now we're not, the state is not recouping anything from, because we've taxed only the cultivator and not the retail sale. So, you know, as a tax structure, as we've seen the industry change and there be a lot more product, value-added products coming out of the cannabis industry, going to a sales tax allows our tax to recoup some of that. Now, I know you as a developer of, you know, both a cultivator and a manufacturer, that's probably where you've found a niche and pursued a profitability, but sharing that tax, that potential profit with the state is still appealing to me, and it was one of the things that stood out to me to the Cannabis Tax Task Force. So I guess I'm looking to just understand that piece a little bit more of, I know we need some change. We're losing revenue right now, a decline in revenue in the cannabis industry and some risk to the industry. But I think the state, I have an interest in making sure that we also benefit from securing the industry and is its 21st century development, right? I'm old school. I was a child of the 60s. So the cannabis industry looks very different than it did when I was a teenager. And I think there's a modernization where we look to a sales tax to recoup some of that potential profit that both manufacturers should benefit from and our tax coffers. So talk to me about that.
Yeah.
Ms. Wilcox?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Hannon, I personally have spoken to this committee about value had on cannabis, and I think that there's a lot of opportunity there. I think a lot of manufacturers have done, as I have done, where they've slowed down some of that innovation because the cultivators that perhaps they buy their material from are struggling. So I think you're right that there is a conversation that needs to happen. I get really nervous that every year we don't help the cultivator with a more immediate solution because of the more complicated conversation we need to have about the percent, the number, where it goes. I think that it's a continued conversation we need to have, and I think 6% feels pretty high to people depending on where you are in the state.
Thank you.
Okay, do we have any further questions for public testimony, Ms. Lacey Wilcox? Seeing none, thank you very much, Ms. Wilcox, for your testimony.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else in the room or online who would like to testify? Seeing none, if folks would like to submit written testimony, they can do so by emailing us at house.finance@akleg.gov. What I would like to do is set an amendment deadline. We want to give folks a good amount of time, so I'll set it for just over a week from now, Wednesday, March 25th at noon. This will give folks plenty of time to work on those with a sponsor as well as the Department of Revenue for any amendments that you might be considering. And if you do have amendments, please provide those to Mr. Anderson or our finance clerk, Ms. Helen Phillips. Representative Carrick, do you have any comments with regard to any of the discussion that's occurred?
Just Co-Chair Foster for the record, Ashley Carrick, representative for House District 35. Just want to thank the committee for the great questions and discussion today. And my comment would just be, I think what you heard in public testimony today is really reflective of the problem before you. That House Bill 91 tries to strike a balance to address, which is on the one hand, the potential for continued lost revenue overall in the industry. And with this legislation, some amount of lost revenue for programs that are excellent, that are being served, but also the potential for significant growth in the industry with greater stabilization. And just wanted to say I'm very open to anybody's offices here wanting to reach out and talk about how do we strike that balance. It's my opinion that House Bill 91 strikes that balance, but I do think that there's a lot of things to consider, and I really just appreciate the committee's time in spending on this.
Great. Thank you very much. So with that, I am going to go ahead and set aside HB 91, And what I'd like to do is we just have one final bill before us today. I'd like to take just a 2-minute break to let everybody stretch their legs, grab some coffee. And when we come back, we'll come back to House Bill 52. That's minors in psychiatric hospitals. We're only going to get a brief recap on the bill, review the updated fiscal note, set an amendment deadline and set that bill aside. So it shouldn't take too long. So with that, we'll take a brief at ease at 2:42 PM. Okay, I am going to very slowly call House Finance back to order. Allow folks a little bit of time to come back into the room. The more I talk, the more I can get give folks time to get back. So I'm calling House Finance back to order at 2:48 p.m. It's Tuesday, March 17th. And with that, as I mentioned earlier, we are now shifting over to House Bill 52, and that is Minors in Psychiatric Hospitals. We heard the bill last session on May 15, 2025. We heard the bill. We've also taken some public testimony. We received review of the fiscal notes last year. We do have a new fiscal note. So what I intend to do is just get a brief recap from Representative Dybert, and we'll hear the updated information regarding the updated fiscal notes. We'll set an amendment deadline, and then we'll set the bill aside. So with that, I'd like to go ahead and invite up Representative Dybert and her staff, Ms. Almeria Alcantara. And so with that, please come on up and put yourself on the record. Just so folks know, we also have online available for questions, Matthew Thomas, Department of Health, Bruce Downs, Office of Children's Services, David Flatten, a Division of Juvenile Justice. And so with that, Representative Dybert, did you want to kick it off or did you want to defer to Ms. Almeria?
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I'll go ahead and kick it off.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Chair Foster and members of the House Finance Committee. For the record, Maxine Dybert, representative for House District 31 or Downtown Fairbanks. Thank you to the co-chair and the committee for bringing this important piece of legislation forward today and hearing it. It's been a while, like you had mentioned, since we last heard this bill, and I'd like to start today's hearing by reminding members and the public tuning in why we chose to bring this bill forward. This bill was crafted in 2022, following an extensive investigation that the Department of Justice found that the state of Alaska was in violation of Title II of the Americans with Disabilities Act. This investigation concluded that children with disabilities were being institutionalized at high rates and for extended periods of time, with Alaska Native children disproportionately affected. These are not our characterizations. This language comes directly from the Department of Justice's findings, and you can find the DOJ's full report on BASIS within the documents of this bill. We also want to remind the committee and the public of the goals of this bill and this legislation. The most important part of this bill is that it brings transparency. Transparency to the way our minors are treated in psychiatric hospitals in the state. The bill mandates this transparency in three ways. First, it mandates that minors undergoing inpatient mental health evaluation and treatment have access to confidential communication with their parent, legal guardian, or approved adult. And this communication happens each week for at least 2 cumulative hours. The bill requires the Department of Health to prepare and submit an annual report to the legislature containing information on the seclusion and restraints used by hospital staff, as well as findings from the mandatory inspections outlined in Section 4 of the bill. And lastly, the bill requires that if and when a psychiatric hospital uses seclusion or restraint, including chemical, mechanical, or physical restraint, they must notify the Department of Health and the minor's guardian no later than 72 hours after the incident occurs. With that, we all know that there is a mental health crisis in our state. What committee members might not know is that 13,000 Alaskan adolescents experience a major depressive episode each year, or that 9,000 Alaska adolescents have serious thoughts of suicide each year, and this information was brought by NAMI 2025. Mr. Chairman, these are alarming numbers. If we want to help our children facing mental health crisis, we must ensure that the facilities providing treatment to our youth are held at the highest standard, which this bill, this legislation aims to do. Again, I'd like to thank the committee for taking the time today to hear House Bill 52. My staff, Almaria Alcantara, is available to read through the sectional analysis and assist in answering any detailed questions the committee may have.
Okay, thank you. Let me just take a quick look at the sectional here. Maybe can you just hit the high points, Ms. Almaria, on the sectional?
Yes. For the record, Almaria Alcantara, staff to Representative Dybert. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Hitting the high points of the sectional, Section 1 amends AS 47.30 by adding a new section mandating a minor's right, unless prohibited by law or court order, to confidential communication with their legal guardian or approved adult each week for at least 2 cumulative hours. Section 2 amends subsections E and F, directing the Department of Health to prepare an annual report to the legislature containing information on the types of seclusion and restraint used on a minor. Subsection F directs the Department of Family and Community Services to collect data on minors receiving both in-state and out-of-state residential psychiatric care to include in its annual report. And then jumping to Section 4, which is a note that the representative hit, Section 4 creates AS 47.32.110D, directing the Department of Health to conduct at least 2 unannounced inspections of any psychiatric hospital providing evaluation or inpatient treatment to a minor in the state. During these inspections, the department must conduct private interviews with at least 50% of the minor patients. And those hit all the sections that the representative spoke to prior.
Great, thank you. I've got 2 questions, Representative Josephson and then Stapp. Representative Josephson.
Yes. through the chair to Ms. Alcantara. Does this also apply to minors out of state that are Alaska citizens?
For the record, Almaria Alcantara, through the chair to co-chair Josephson, this bill directly impacts those psychiatric hospitals within the state of Alaska.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair to Ms. Alcantara. First, thanks for being here. Always good to see the representative from the other side of the stees here in the Finance Committee. So I guess a couple of questions. I can't remember, so sorry if you've answered this question from last time. The reporting requirements about the Department of Health and DFCS creating and then documenting and sending the legislature another report, was that part of the auditor's recommendations when they went through this through the chair?
Ms. Alcantara?
For the record, Almaria Alcantara, through the chair to Representative Stapp. When you say auditors, are you referring to the Department of Justice?
Yeah, correct, through the chair, sorry.
Thank you. For the record, Almaria Alcantara, in my research through that document, a lot of the recommendations that came out of the report were mainly focused on creating more community-based services. They do highlight a couple other issues, noting issues with overuse of restraint, also overuse of medication, which this bill aims to fix. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think that's sufficient. If all, Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair, through the chair. Ms. Alcantara. So regarding Section 4 and 5, so in the previous Section 2, we're also asking the Department of Family and Community Services to do a report, but in 4 and 5, we're only asking the Health Department to conduct the inspections of the psychiatric hospital. I am not super well versed in which department actually runs that, but I'm curious, does the Department of Family and Community Services have any kind of connection to that through the chair?
Ms. Alcantara.
For the record, Almarie Alcantara, through the chair to Representative Stapp. In Section 2 of the bill, you're correct that in subsection F, the bill directs the Department of Family and Community Services to collect data on minors receiving in-state and out-of-state care. Another part of that section is looking at how long they're receiving this care for. Then if you jump to Section 4 and 5, the report is actually conducted through Department of Health, but Department of Family and Community Services are required to provide that data to the Department of Health to include in their annual report.
Just a quick follow-up.
Representative Stapp?
So just on it, does it matter if the health, I mean, so when I read this language in Section 4, it says a designated agent or employee of the Department of Health shall conduct the inspections. Would that be super material if does the bill allow the health department to designate someone from Department of Family Community Services to do the inspection, or does it have to be the health department through the chair?
For the record, Almarie Alcantara, through the chair to Representative Stapp, looking at the language in Section 4, it does say designated agent or employee of the Department of Health. So from my reading of that, that would not include Family and Community Services.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, do we have any further questions? Okay, seeing none, we'll jump over to the updated fiscal notes. The first one we have is from Mr. Bruce Downs, Community Relations Manager, regarding the Children's Services Management. Mr. Downs, if you could put yourself on the record and then maybe read the control code that you have in the bottom right of your fiscal note.
I apologize. This is Bruce Downs with the Office of Children's Services. Could you repeat that?
Yes, if you could walk us through the fiscal note, it should be OMB component 3321. And if you could just verify that the control code that you have in the bottom right of the fiscal note is TSRYX.
Yes, Chair, that's the document I have in front of me.
Okay, and if you could just give us an update on that fiscal note.
The Office of Children's Services doesn't anticipate a fiscal impact. Currently, we do track children who are in our custody and placed in a psychiatric hospital, so we would be able to provide this data to the Department of Health as part of our normal job duty.
Okay, Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Kutcher Foster, through the chair to our fiscal person at DFCS. In the fiscal note, it says the department may lack statutory authority to collect data on minors who are not in its custody for reporting purposes. And when I read the bill, it kind of sounds like you're supposed to do that for people who, at least the outside of the state portion that Kutcher Josephson referenced earlier. So how would we, if we're going to ask you to submit data to the Department of Health, do we know how that is possible in the event that you lack statutory authority? Or what statutory authority would you require to be able to kind of execute the nucleus of the bill through the chair?
Mr. Downs?
For the record, this is Bruce Downs with OCS. Through the chair, Representative Stapp. I don't know that we would have authority to collect any private health information for children who are not in OCS's custody. So I would actually seek guidance on how we would collect that.
Representative Stapp.
Thanks.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, and Chair Foster, I missed his name, but to the gentleman from OCS, could you articulate in there, because I think there may be some confusion about in custody, because I think in your fiscal note, you mean a child who is assigned to OCS versus my own personal child who I've placed into a psychiatric hospital, that's the difference, versus they're in the state of Alaska versus an Oregon hospital.
Mr. Downs?
Yes, for the record, this is Bruce Downs with OCS through the chair, Representative Cannon. We currently only submit data to the Department of Health regarding children who are currently in OCS custody. My understanding is the Department of Health has data on Alaskan children who are placed in psychiatric hospitals.
Follow-up. And Mr. Thank you, Chair Foster. And Mr. Downs, that would be children who are in OCS's custody, whether their placement is in Alaska or outside of Alaska, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, that would be correct.
Thank you.
Okay. Do we have any further questions for Mr. Downs?
Yes.
Representative Josephson?
Just to be clear, Mr. Downs, as you understand it, this bill would apply to not just OCS, children in OCS's custody, but also in juvenile justice, in court-ordered psychiatric care, anyone who touches the police power of the government in any way. Isn't that right? Or is that how you see it?
Mr. Downs.
For Chair Representative Josephson, we have David Platten here with Division of Juvenile Justice, who may be able to offer some opinion.
Could you repeat that, Mr. Downs?
Mr. Flayton, I guess, or Flatten.
Yes, sorry. I know I have David Flatten also on the line, who may be able to offer that opinion as it pertains to children in Division of Juvenile Justice.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Flatten. If you could put yourself on the record.
Thank you. For the record, David Flotten, Division of Juvenile Justice. To Co-Chair Josephson, that is correct. Youth in the custody of the Division of Juvenile Justice, our understanding is the legislation would be applicable to those youth as well, whether they were placed out of state or in state in the residential psychiatric centers.
All right. Yeah, follow up.
Follow up.
And what about a child who's committed no crimes, no one alleges crimes, is not in foster care, has suitable parents, essentially, but is, I guess, I'm thinking of Rep. Hannon's hypothetical, is, I don't know enough about juvenile law to know whether there would need to be a court order, probably not. So in the hypothetical where there's no state contact at all, we just wouldn't have that data. Is that right? Under this bill.
Mr. Flotten.
For the record, David Flotten, Division of Juvenile Justice. If there was no crime committed, the youth would never be under the custody of the Division of Juvenile Justice. And if they weren't in foster care, my understanding, again, Mr. Downs can correct me, they would not be in the custody of the Office of Children's Services, and thus they wouldn't fall under the legislation under subsection F.
Last follow-up.
Follow-up.
Are there circumstances where there's no foster care case, there's no juvenile justice case, but there is a commitment proceeding, or is there something this bill should be considering capturing that it doesn't, or is there some set of facts that it doesn't respond to?
Mr. Flotten?
Excuse me, to Co-Chair Josephson, I would hesitate to speak on those other minors that could be impacted. As far as those that are within the custody or under the jurisdiction of the Department of Family and Community Services, I believe they'd all be covered. I would defer to the bill's sponsor if youth that weren't under the Department of Family and Community Services are covered by the intentions of the bill.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Do we have any further questions? Seeing none, we're going to go to the second of three fiscal notes, and the next one is actually, Mr. David Flotten, if you could walk us through the fiscal note. I believe the OMB component is 3314, and if you could cite your control code at the bottom right of the fiscal notes.
Thank you to the chair, David Flotten, Juvenile Justice, control code JBXMK.
Oh, I've got NCGZM. And it's dated March 13, 2026. And that's OMB component 3314. Is that correct?
That's correct. Component number is correct.
Looks like the date by the division was January 28, but the approved by dates was March 13. So it sounds like we might have a different fiscal note than what you have, but I assume that you have a zero fiscal note in front of you, or is there a change?
Through the co-chair, that is correct. It's a zero fiscal note. The Division of Juvenile Justice can provide the requested information to the Department of Health with no additional cost.
Okay. And is that the entirety of the update that you wanted to give regarding the fiscal note version that you have before you?
Correct, co-chair.
Okay, thank you. We should get the corrected. And can you repeat the fiscal, the control code that you have on your fiscal note, and then we'll make sure we get a copy of that to our committee. If you could repeat that that control code number.
Control code is capital J, lowercase b, X, M, capital K.
Okay, thank you. I've got that written down, and we'll get that sorted out. But it sounds like we've got the same information, and that's the important part. So do we have any questions for Mr. Flotten? I don't see any. So next we're going to go to the last fiscal note, and that is Mr. Matthew Thomas. If you're online, can you state your name and your affiliation and walk us through your position and walk us through the fiscal note?
Yes, thank you. For the record, Matthew Thomas, Nurse Consultant 2, Division of Healthcare Services. Through the chair, my OMB component number is 2944. Control code RKYBX.
Okay, and that's what we have also. So if you could walk us through this fiscal note.
Yeah, absolutely. For fiscal year 27, requested appropriation is $185,800 for personal services, $35,000 for services, and $5,000 for commodities, totaling $225,800 for the initial year with one requested full-time position. The HFLC allocation would require one nurse consultant beginning in year one. This position will assist with program development, creating regulations, designing necessary forms, provide training and other necessary framework to support this legislation. The costs associated with this position and necessary support infrastructure would include personal services at $185,800 annually for one nurse consultant, including benefits at a range 24 in Anchorage. Services for $20,000 annually for office-based phone reimbursement service agreements to support the position, and $15,000 annually for two nurse consultant ones to attend trauma-informed care and cultural awareness training. With a one-time commodity cost of $5,000 in FY27 for computer software and office equipment, and then the out years of commodities would reduce to $2,000 annually for office supplies. And finally, this fiscal note is general fund because this legislation addresses state licensure rather than a Medicaid requirement.
Okay. Do we have any questions for Mr. Thomas, Representative Galvin?
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. And I'm sure Co-Chair Justison knows more about this, but I'm curious, the note at the bottom that said rather than a Medicaid requirement, are you suggesting then that there are no waiver opportunities for something like this service to be provided to patients who may be under Medicaid care?
For the record, Matthew Thomas, Nurse Clinton 2, Division of Healthcare Services, through the chair to the representative. This legislation speaks only to the licensure requirements of the healthcare facility, the psychiatric healthcare facility, mm-hmm. as opposed to a Medicaid recipient per se.
I see. And if I may have the follow up, Co-Chair Foster, but the reasoning for having this level of a care provider in front of the said patient is that there is some understanding that this patient should only be interviewed by an expert of a certain level of provider. And so I'm just trying to sort that out. I truly don't know anything about Medicaid, but I'm hoping to generate some discussion of someone who may know more, because it just feels like if we're putting in a requirement based on level of care aptitude, that it may be that there might have been some opportunity for charging Medicaid for that. But I really don't know enough about it. So thank you.
Okay. Do we have any further questions for Mr. Thomas? Okay, I don't see any, so thank you very much for that update. Just to go back to the previous fiscal note that we had with Mr. Flatten, I just received a note from staff, and it says that the fiscal note in our packets is the most updated fiscal note. It is the correct one. That is the NCGZM, and the one that was being referred to by Mr. Flatten, it sounds like that might have been the updated or the fiscal note from March 21, 2025. My question to staff is, why was there a need to update the fiscal note if the new one has the same information as the last one? So maybe there was no change to the numbers on the front, but possibly a change in the analysis section behind, and we'll figure that out and get back to the committee. Actually, Mr. Anderson, do you have an answer now?
For the record, Brody Anderson, staff to Representative Foster. Mr. Chairman, I do have the answer for the committee right now. If you go to your fiscal note that is dated the control code NCGZM, going to the description page, on both of the Department of Family and Community Services, both fiscal notes have been edited with this final sentence on the bottom of the second paragraph. However, the department may lack statutory authority to collect data on minors who are not in custody for its reporting purposes. That is the only change to the fiscal notes. The verbiage up until that point was the same on both fiscal notes. And then when they updated the fiscal note to this year's fiscal year 27, they chose to add that language this year.
Okay, great. Do we have any questions on that change for this fiscal note? Seeing none, thank you very much, Mr. Anderson. Okay, so I think we have reached the end of our time here. I would like to set an amendment deadline for this bill, and that will be Friday, March 20th at 5 p.m. And please provide those to either my staff, Mr. Brody Anderson, or Ms. Helen Phillips. While we have the sponsor, do we have any other questions on the bill? Seeing none. Okay, thank you. Our next meeting is scheduled for tomorrow at 1:30, and at that meeting we'll hear a presentation on state leases from the Department of Transportation, and then we'll have public testimony on House Bill 193, which is unemployment benefits paid parental leave. And so if there's nothing else to come for the committee, we will be adjourned at 3:16 p.m. Thank you.